I'm a big believer that if it doesn't work on a bear, you don't do it in the ring.
I wear the fanny pack like it's a thunderbolt from freaking Zeus.
Weapons are not only welcome, they're allowed.
You kick my dog, I'ma kick your cat.
This is sure life.
Hey, Colt Cabana, how you doing?
You're all like big, fat, failure turtles.
Welcome back to a V2 Wrestling special this evening. Gavin and I are delighted to welcome to the show the three-time world heavyweight champ, two-time WCW champion, Lex Luger. Good evening, Lex.
Good evening, guys. How y'all doing?
We're doing fantastic. And obviously, you're over in America tonight. And do you want to tell our listeners what you're actually doing at this moment?
Well, I don't know. This may be taped delayed, but I'm watching live my Big Red, Manchester United, getting ready to stomp Chelsea.
Well, as of time of speaking, I think it's still 0-0, isn't it?
It is.
I'm hoping that United win, which I don't usually want them to win, but on this occasion, I think this could be quite a painful interview if Chelsea start scoring and Lex is sounding really depressed.
I'll try to keep a grip on it. I got it on with the volume off in the background. I'll try not to look at it too much.
I'll try
to focus on the interview.
If they score and you do cuss, don't worry about it. we can edit it out, don't worry. So the reason why we've got Lex on this evening, obviously, you know, it's a great honour to have him on the show. But Lex has just written his first book, Wrestling with the Devil. So I've read it, and we'll go into it in a little while. But why did you write the book in the first place, Lex? What was the reason behind it?
Well, first off, I have to make a minor correction. Lex has written that you have to use that term very loosely, because I had a lot of help, because I'm a guy who had trouble with a two-page essay back in school. So I told my story, and thanks to Tyndale Publishing and John Hollis, a good writer, we put it in legible form. And really the reason I did it, I was one of those guys who never thought I'd do a book for the obvious reason I just previously stated, number one. But number two, a lot of my family, everybody else, they were kind of like not, let me put it in a nice way I can, strongly in favor. They thought it was kind of like, why don't you just leave it alone and move forward? So, but too many of my mentors and people in my life figure I had a story to share that they thought would be inspiring. And they thought it would be the best way to get it out there. So Tyndale came along, and John Hollis, the writer locally here, good friend of mine, came stepped up the bat. So I'm really pleased with how it turned out. And really, it's just to share my story and have it be an encouragement to others out there. But that hope is never lost.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a fascinating tale. And obviously, you talk about all the bad stuff before you get to where you are now in your life. And it is absolutely gripping throughout the whole book. One thing I was quite surprised about was how candid you were about all the bad stuff that you did in your career. That must have been quite hard revisiting some of that.
Yeah, I was pleased how it turned out. Wrestling was a phenomenal 15-year, like the 4th of July fireworks. I got to work with every single top competitor in my generation of wrestlers, the pay-per-views, the travel all over the world, met all kinds of wonderful people. The wrestling fans are second to none. So that part of my life was fabulous. I wanted to be very candid about a lot of the bad decisions that I made outside of wrestling, living a double life, so to speak. And I definitely wanted to share that with people and let them know behind the scenes my life was unraveling and that there's a good ending. But I wanted to be very, you know, I didn't want to leave anything out. So I'm very pleased how I handled that as well. The blame lies squarely on my shoulders. I made those decisions, and they did a good job with that as well.
If I can just interrupt, do you think, Lex, that the fact that you were so successful so quickly was part of what led to that kind of downward spiral? Did it go to your head? Because you, I mean, within a couple of years of debuting, you were sort of main eventing in the NWA, later WCW. And then you kind of stayed at that level for pretty much the rest of your career. So was it too much too soon?
In retrospect, yeah. I didn't think so at the time. I thought I had it all together. But yeah, in retrospect, definitely. Too Much Too Fast. You see with guys from and Wall Street or over in London there in the financial district. You see with rock stars, actors. I definitely fell into that Too Much Too Soon, Too Much Success, and ended up really buying into it. And no doubt, I did not handle it well in retrospect.
Interestingly enough, obviously a big part of your downfall was doing, you know, steroids, and also you said about having a buzz when you're in the wrestling. But what I was quite surprised about reading the book was that you were already in that steroid life cycle in your footballing career.
Oh, yeah, I started the drugs back in American football, and it was very common. It wasn't even classified as an illegal drug back in the early days. We found out about all our stuff from the cyclists and the track and field guys back then. And then the bodybuilders, we got it like fourth hand. It went from the cyclists and track and field guys to the bodybuilders, and we kind of got our info from the bodybuilders and how to cycle and take it. And that was really how I got started. I wanted to gain a bunch of weight real quick. I got out of college football for a while. I was down in warm weather down in Florida. I'd lost some weight and wanted to gain weight real quick. And I started on it, and it was a shortcut to the work. And that started my cycling on what they lovingly refer to as PEDs now.
Mm-hmm. Performance-enhancing drugs, yeah, of course. So I mean, with regards to that, I mean, that was a big revelation there that you said cyclists do drugs.
Oh, yeah. What we always learned from them. I was when all this Lance Armstrong and all this other stuff came out, and you know, I always knew. We were always learning from the Olympians and the cyclist guys, for sure.
Did you, looking back, you know, when you were at your lowest point, did you think, I wish I would have stayed playing American football? And how far do you think you would have gone? Because at the time, you were in the Canadian Professional League, weren't you, when... Were you just coming back down to the U.S., weren't you, from memory, from reading the book?
Yeah, I was getting ready to turn to the NFL at the time. And now, in retrospect, wrestling turned out to be a phenomenal decision. The only problem I had is, like we said, my decisions that I made with Jason getting carried away with fame and money and that chase and chasing women. My people, my mentors, my let's call it the life of folly. I based my life, and I call it the book, I based my life on the sand instead of the rock. I was chasing the life of folly instead of building on the rock. God, my family, you know, friends who really meant something to me. So that's where I got off track. My decision from football to wrestling went splendidly. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, but yeah, it really wasn't that decision. No regrets there.
Just looking back at the wrestling part of it, you were chained by Matsudo, and very quickly you fell in with Flair. How did that friendship come about?
Oh, man, he came down to Florida my first year of wrestling, and we did an hour Broadway, and he was so incredible. Rick's always not only been a big star, but a star maker. I was so new, he called a move, which is a very standard wrestling, called a sunset flip. I didn't know what it was yet. I remember Rick's exasperation during the match, like, oh my gosh, this guy. But he went back to which was WCW, NWA at the time, when just ran and raved about what he thought was my potential. So I really, after Hero My Seed being my initial mentor, Rick really became my second mentor, and really was instrumental in my growth and my getting a real break, and really coming in with the Horsemen, which was a huge break at the time. I didn't even realize how big that was. Mm. And Rick was very instrumental in all that. I have a lot of gratitude for him for all that.
So, were you not a wrestling fan growing up then? I mean, if you weren't aware of the Sunset Flip and that kind of thing, did you not follow the industry as a
I did. My first match I did, I speak in the book, my first live wrestling match I went to was my debut.
So you really were completely clueless to what you were getting into.
And some people say I remain so for the rest of my career.
that wouldn't be true at all. I think you
Matt Pluto always tell me, don't try to learn too much. Stick to the basics and just flex and show your body. He goes, that's your calling card, he said. He goes, you can learn all that fancy stuff. Let all the high flyers do that. He said, just stand, just stay in top shape and look good. And he goes, They can't They can't get that. That's going to be your calling card. So I took that to the extreme.
But you were a natural to begin with. I've seen some of your matches from the sort of US title reign in the late 80s. I think there was one, Ricky Steamboat, 89, that I remember being a particularly good match. There were a couple of great matches I remember against Brian Pillman. And you seemed like you acclimatized very quickly to what is needed from a wrestling performer.
Well, I can't take much credit there either, guys, because really, when you get to work with Ric Flairs and all those guys, and Ricky Steamboats, these guys were tacticians, technicians. It started there. I don't know if you noticed, but they always matched me up with a lot of the premier, what we call workers, in the ring in the business. So really, to be honest with you, at my level of experience at that time, those guys really carry, not just me, but guys with even some of the biggest stars in the business weren't regarded as maybe the premier, once again, ring technicians or tacticians. They always had to be in there with really good top guys like Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat. I was very fortunate to be able to work with those kind of guys. Bret Hart is renowned for that. I got to work with all the premier guys. So even though I was inexperienced, it may have appeared I was picking up on it quickly, but I really have to give all the credit to those guys, to be honest with you, in retrospect.
So are you genuinely quite quite humble about your own skills? Do you not feel that you were?
I am now. I wasn't then. I thought it was all me.
But it was an interesting.
Now looking back, you don't.
I'm looking back in retrospect with a little bit of wisdom goggles on. Now I can see that how fortunate I was to be matched up with those kind of guys and how they handpicked those guys for me. They liked my look that I had, but they always matched me up with really experienced, incredible guys in the ring. And I really benefited from that greatly, of course, looking back on it now. But the time I thought I was thinking, boy, how wonderful am I?
There was an interesting.
I really am the total package.
I was going to say, there was an interesting part in the book where you're in with another so-called technician. I think, was it Kurt Hennig or was it Paul Orndorff? I can't remember, but where you both faced each other and you were both expecting the other one to lead, which was quite a funny story.
Yes. That was my WrestleMania debut. Mr. Perfect, also renowned, they matched him up, especially my first WrestleMania, of course. Vince wanted to be so good. I got in the ring, and Kurt, one of the best workers ever, I thought at first he was kidding me, but I thought I had a night off, so I was sitting back in the locker room like, man, I got Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, ring man extraordinaire, I got a night off. So I was all relaxed. I didn't think much about the match. He'd lead me right through it. I got in the ring. We talked about pretty much the structure of the match beforehand to make sure I had it. We got in the ring, and Kurt blanked out. He said, what are we doing? I was like, what do you mean, what are we doing? You're leading the match.
So how did you get around the match?
Yeah, well, I had to end up calling the match, and we struggled through it. But that definitely wasn't the debut they had in mind for me. Of course, they blamed me.
Well, they're not going to blame Kurt, are they?
No, when I wasn't a stooge animal, I wasn't going to be like a little telltale. Well, Kurt blanked out, you know.
I'd like to ask about another wrestler you had a match with around when you were in the NWA, called Mean Mark. I remember seeing a match between you and Mean Mark, who went on to become the Undertaker. Do you remember him from that time?
Oh yeah, I have on YouTube. This is funny. Mark might not think it's very funny, but his last match at WCW pay-per-view, I on a dare from Ric Flair, he dared me. I always wore black tights usually. He dared me to wear something colorful. And just to rip the nature boy, I wore pink tights. So my joke with Undertaker always is, hey, I torture racked you in a pay-per-view with pink tights on. What do you think of that, Mr. Undertaker?
Yeah, if that ever got out, that would be his streak over, wouldn't it? They would just say, that's it, bury him now.
Maybe that's how they're planning to end the streak. Maybe they're going to bring you back with your pink pants to end the streak.
No, no. That was a one-time deal. I definitely wouldn't want to face The Undertaker now. What a great career. My goodness.
I'm obviously conscious of time tonight, Lex, so I'm going to fast forward a little bit now, and obviously you carried on wrestling with WCW and then joined Vince McMahon in WWF as it was then, and you had the whole Lex Express thing going on. You had another great story at the beginning of your face turn where you turned up in cowboy boots and didn't think you could pick up Yokozuna.
Oh yeah, I was like on roller skates or ice skates when I got in the ring, because I'd practice in like Nikes, but I had good traction at the office, and it still was questionable whether we're going to be able to do it. We thought with the adrenaline in front of the crowd, it'd go okay. I got in the ring, and I couldn't even stand up hardly in my boots. They were worn in the bottom, so Yoko basically, to make a long story short, slams himself. I was almost no help. He was so agile, it was incredible.
Hmm.
So Yokozuna should have been the American hero then, for managing to slam Yokozuna.
Exactly. Behind the scenes, yes. Thank goodness for Yoko.
The Yokozuna Express. It doesn't have the same ring, does it?
No.
No.
So,
Sorry, just to pick up on that, the Lex Express is kind of looked back upon. I'm going to try and say it nicely, but it's kind of looked back upon as a little bit of a flop.
I mean, some people that actually the tour itself, we used to have people lined up everywhere we went. It was magnificent. I mean, we'd go to like Toys R Us and they'd line up three times around the building. The response to the tour was good. Some people just didn't like the finish at SummerSlam. They thought it was kind of like they let the air out of the tires on the bus.
Yeah, because it was a count out victory, wasn't it?
Yeah, so everybody thought that was kind of a letdown.
So,
not everybody. I didn't think. I mean, I was never promised anything. Like people, contrary to what people thought. So, I was already told that if they were to do anything with me, if they were, that's not. No, I said again, if they said we would do it at WrestleMania 10 at the Garden. So I already knew that the SummerSlam Lexus Express was not good enough for the world title win. So those who felt the momentum was lost, they have a point, maybe. But that, the intent all along was if Vince was going to maybe put the belt on me, it would have been at WrestleMania 10 because he already had a big program worked out with The Undertaker and Yokozuna right after SummerSlam.
I'd like to ask a question. I know that Adam's trying to keep this on track and I keep taking us off track. But you mentioned WrestleMania 10. There's a myth that you were originally supposed to win the title at WrestleMania 10 and that the plans were changed kind of right at the last second.
I know.
Is there any truth to that?
No. My goodness, I read that. They even put it in my Wikipedia for a while, which shows you how truthful Wikipedia is, which is not. I saw it go, what are they talking about? I actually, for the first time in my career, my wife had a great friend. They said I was in a hotel drunk the night before WrestleMania, giving out the finish that I was going to be the champion. And so Vince got mad and decided to change it. I read that, I laughed because I was nowhere near WrestleMania. I was in Hartford, Connecticut with my wife and kids all that week because that's where her friend lived. That wasn't anywhere near New York City or hotel.
Thank you for dispelling that myth.
Yes.
It's nice to finally have the truth.
I find it humorous. I made enough bad decisions. I go, I didn't need any embellishment.
No. Well, just to
move. They didn't need to make anything up. I made enough bad decisions.
Yeah, that's the truth. On that note, I was going to ask you the next one. Was leaving WWF without telling Vince and turning up on WCW the same night. Was that something that you would consider a mistake, or was it right now and at the time?
Oh, well, a huge breach in etiquette. I mean, looking back now, I never would do it. Mm-hmm. I would hope I'd be a man of honor and integrity and give Vince a notice and leave properly. But part of the agreement at the time that WCW wanted, they wanted a surprise with the newness of the internet at the time, always getting the scoop. They wanted it to be a total surprise. So they said, the only condition we have is if you come on board with WCW, you can't tell Vince you're leaving. And I was uncomfortable with it, but I did it at the time. And in retrospect now, I would hope I would never do something like that. So yeah, that was definitely not the right thing to do, for sure.
I find it amazing.
From what I understand, Vince was not very pleased, and I don't blame him.
Well, I was going to say, I find it amazing that you were, you say in your book that you were out of contract for 6 months, and you were working without a contract all that time.
Yeah, but that still hasn't changed. I was on his television. Mm. They had to go back in and take me off their television shows. when that happened. I mean, even though I wasn't under contract anymore officially, Vince was very good to me while I was there. He used to invite me over his home and hang out, and he was very good to me. With the relationship him and I had, even if we didn't have such a good relationship, I should have definitely done the honorable thing and give him at least a 2-week notice.
When you went back to WCW, quite a lot of had changed since you'd last been there, and Eric Bischoff was running the company. And he says that when you returned, he lowballed you quite substantially.
Oh, definitely.
And you accepted the low offer.
I did. I never lacked confidence that if I got in there and they gave me the chance to prove myself, that I'd be a valuable commodity to them. And Eric, I have to admit, was very fair. He re-upped my contract over and over again, even before it came due as things took off. So Eric, even though he wasn't a big fan of mine, he admitted he wasn't. He really took care of me that whole time I was with WCW that second time.
Once again, I'm conscious of time. And one of the things I find the most fascinating about the book was that when you move, you're in WCW and you admitted, you know, you were taking performance enhancing drugs. I think it was on your second run that you started taking them with them. But you said in your book that you, when you were in WWF, you didn't. Now, were the management aware in WCW of all, you know, the PEDs that were being taken and the human growth hormone, all this stuff?
They were testing at the time, but we were cheating on the tests. False samples, etc. So they legitimately were testing, and they did not approve of it. And if you got caught, there were penalties involved. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like a wink, wink kind of thing. They definitely had testing and rules in place, but guys like me and a lot of the other guys were finding ways around the testing at the time.
Sure. Well, look, this is a fascinating conversation, X, and I know we're slightly hampered with time, and I want to get onto the positive stuff and not look back at just the negative as well. I appreciate that there's a big section in the book as well about your relationship with Elizabeth and her death and things like that. Obviously, it's a fascinating read and quite, you know, heartbreaking when you're reading it and things like that, your recollection of it. I don't want to do it really a disjustice and try and cover it in a few minutes today. Is there anything that you want to say about that time? Or, Gavin, have you got any questions before we move on to the positive stuff?
I would like to ask one question about the Elizabeth situation. And I really hope you don't mind me asking. But around the time, WWE had a show called Confidential. And I recall that they, after Elizabeth died, they kind of aired an episode where it was quite, it made it out to be, well, obviously, I mean, it was scandalous, but they scandalized the situation by playing your 911 call, I believe, from what I remember. And it seemed almost as though you were being painted as the bad guy in the situation. And I just wondered how you kind of felt about it at the time and how you feel now looking back, if you remember that situation.
I never saw that. I'd heard about it at the time. I really got isolated at the time from my attorneys, everybody. I didn't see that stuff. However, I was a bad guy in a bad situation at the time. I tell young people now when I speak in front of youth groups that we reap what we sow, and there's ramifications for everybody around. It's not just, hey, it's my body, I do what I do with drugs or alcohol and things. There's a ripple effect. And Elizabeth was highly respected, the first lady in wrestling, she always will be, and it was a real tragedy. And I definitely was a strong influence on her, and I definitely played a role. And people, well, why do you need to force her to make those decisions to take drugs or alcohol? I go, no, but I was definitely a strong influence in her time, so definitely regrets over that. Obviously, it was a horrible loss and a tragedy. And whatever WWE did at the time, yes, it was scandalous. There wasn't any other way of portraying it. And Vince, I think at the time, too, wanted to let people know that, hey, gang, here's what can happen. Mm. So I didn't ever see that, but I never had any hard feelings over them doing that. Because my life is and was what it was back then.
Mm. And what sort of relationship do you have with WWE now, if at all?
Oh, man, they invite me to the every year to WrestleMania and the Hall of Fame, and we have a great relationship now. We're really, really good. So I'm very, very pleased with that. Really, through all the years, Vince has always checked on me, and in spite of everything, and even if it wasn't him directly, through third parties, and I always wanted to know if there's anything he could do to help. I got paralyzed. Vince contacted me and wanted to make sure there's anything he could do to help. So relationship, believe it or not, is very positive now.
I noticed you inducted your best friend in wrestling into the TNA Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it was a real honor to be there and be able to actually speak as one of the Hogan and myself and Dixie Carter were the people who spoke to induct him. It was a real honor to do that. And they wanted me to touch on our friendship, which is very special, which I talk about in the book.
Do you think Sting will ever go to WWE as a swan song, maybe even at this big WrestleMania that's coming up?
Man, as a fan, I'd love to see that. I'd love to see him and Undertaker. Mm-hmm. Then the following year they could induct him in the WWE Hall of Fame. It'd be great. I'd love to see that.
What about yourself going in the WWE Hall of Fame? Do you see that happening?
I don't know. You know, if you ask people 10 years ago, they said never on God's green earth. And some people talk about now, you know, it would be an honor and a privilege, obviously, if I ever did. But who knows?
Obviously, as I said, we know we've only got a certain amount of time for you tonight, Lex, and we'd love to get you back on some other time to talk a bit more about some of your stories. But I just wanted to touch on the final thing which happens in the book, which is obviously you getting your spinal injury in a hotel room and then finding God and those kind of things. So, John, just tell us very quickly the great story about how you met, I think it was Steve, wasn't it? The Pastor Steve, was it?
Yeah, I met him my last time in jail. He shared the good news, the gospel with me on April 23rd of 2006. I shared in the book that I was, I went from an atheist and a Darwinist, and we live, we die. I used to tell people we're worm food, all about science, to a born-again believer. I call it my road to Damascus, supernatural, and on April 23rd of 06. And shortly thereafter, a year and a half later, I woke up in a hotel room paralyzed from the neck down after seeing an airplane the wrong way. And I shared a story how a lot of wonderful doctors and therapists and how God brought me through that as well, through that adversity and the benefits out of my life. I'm not 100% neurologically still, but I'm able to do a lot of things that doctors said I was going to be paralyzed from the neck down the rest of my life. And need 24-hour care, being fed, bathed, and I live on my own, drive myself around here in Atlanta in my car, and I'm very, very thankful that in my recovery, and I'm still hopeful for more recovery yet. So it's been just an amazing, amazing ride.
I just like to comment on how happy you sound. You sound,
oh man,
like such a positive person just speaking to you.
Well, can you imagine telling somebody you're all the top neurologist on the planet, telling you're going to be paralyzed from neck down with no movement the rest of your life and be able to have the health and the abilities I have now, even though it's not what people look at as the old Lex, but man, how happy am I and how thankful. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, it was funny that you said about that story, and also you had the other incident where you had the bike crash as well. Once again, they wanted to amputate your arm at that point. So it's been a miraculous life you've had, really.
It really is. I went from having a crazy, reckless life, one thing after another, and just been God's had a plan for me all along. And I'm just living the dream now.
Well, on that very positive note, I would just really like to thank you for taking the time in joining us tonight, Lex. Your book is out. I'm guessing that people can find it on Amazon and on the website.
Yes, sir. It's LexLugerBook.com, www.LexLugerBook.com, and Amazon, all the major outlets. I had a guy tell me he bought it in a bookstore in Spain today on my Twitter. And my Twitter analyst has info too, @GenuineLexLuger.
Brilliant. Well, we'll make sure we'll put a link at the bottom, but for the time being, Lex, we'd love to have you back on the show sometime in the future, when you have some free time. But I think Gavin will agree it's been an absolute pleasure tonight, and congratulations on a great book.
Yeah, it's been great to speak to you, and I'll have to ask you the rest of my 50 million questions if we ever have you on again.
Hey, guys, great interviews. I would love to be on again. It would be an honor and privilege, and you guys have a great evening.
Thank you.
Good night, Lex.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
And that's Lex out of here. Hopefully you've really enjoyed that interview, and by the sounds of it, he's pleased to come back on any time. So do check out his book. It is a fascinating read. And for the time being, though, just like to thank Gavin for joining me tonight.
It's been a pleasure. It was really nice to hear him just so happy and inspired about life.
Well, absolutely, and hopefully next time that we get him on, we can go into some more of those stories that he told us about there, and also get a little bit more information on obviously the lowest point of his life. But for the time being, thank you for listening to the V2 Wrestling podcast, and we'll be back later on in this week. We've got Gail Kim later on in the week, and we've also got the usual V2 Wrestling podcast. So stay tuned, and we'll see you soon.